And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
What's it mean when whales wink? And what's a whale's wink got to do with what dogs think? We boldly go where others fear to venture into the worlds of anthropomorphosis. It's a special edition of The Voice of the Earth, where we speak, yes, for the animals that try to tell us what they feel and think when the Wild Side News continues. It's a show you're about to love.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Month 2 of the year 2006. Just a bit over a month and a half, and the Wild Side News will celebrate its second full year on air. It's been a most interesting journey, and I'm glad you can listen to this edition of The Voice of the Earth. I ran across an interesting story that must have gotten entangled in the wrappings and trappings over the holidays. It's the story of a 50-foot humpback whale that was streaming along the California coastline, south on its way to the Baja. She was cruising along, free and unencumbered, near the Farallon Islands, which lie about 18 miles off the shore from San Francisco, when she managed to get snagged by a crab trap line. Crab trap lines reach about 240 feet long, with weights 90 pounds each, about every 60 feet. In the effort to get free, the humpback spun and got ever more ensnared. By the time a fisherman discovered her, she was struggling to keep her blowhole above water. The crab fisherman discovered her at about 8:30 in the morning and put out a call to the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito. The whale struggled for 6 hours until help finally arrived when three divers managed to reach her. They found her failing as the ropes had wrapped four times around her tail, had entangled in one of her front flippers, and was caught in her mouth. The divers quickly determined that the only hope was to cut the 20 tight nylon ropes away from her. It took an hour to do so, during which time she remained still except for an unusual shaking. James Mosquito, one of the divers, had the task of cutting the ropes from her mouth, and he clearly recalls what he experienced. He says, "When I was cutting the line going through the mouth, the whale's eye was there winking at me, watching me. It was an epic moment in my life." Eventually, after 7 hours of struggle, the animal was freed. Mosquito recalled what then happened. It began swimming around in circles, and then this 50-foot-long being, that with one swipe of its tail could kill any one of the divers, this humpback swam up to one of the divers and gave him a friendly, affectionate series of nudges. Then she swam to each of her other two rescuers and did the same. Mosquito said it was like a dog that was happy to see you. I never felt threatened. It was an amazing, unbelievable experience. Another diver said, "You hate to anthropomorphize too much, but the whale was doing little dives and the guys were rubbing shoulders with it. I don't know for sure what it was thinking, but it's something that I will always remember. It was just cool." It's yet another amazing story of interspecies communication. And it's what inspires today's show. So many of us are so afraid to acknowledge that animals are so much like us. We say, "We hate to anthropomorphize." Why? I think it's wrong not to, because the animals are very cognitive creatures who definitely share not only a capacity to communicate, but so much more. So today we celebrate anthropomorphization from three perspectives. It's told through our relationships with dogs. We start out with a story I tell about a dog named Apache. Then we talk with a woman who has been working with search and rescue dogs for years and end up with a phenomenal story about a canine companion, a dog named Hawk. Great stuff coming up following the news. And so, the news. President Bush, Tuesday night, delivered his State of the Union address to the nation and to the world. In what appeared to be a surprisingly bold pronouncement from this president was his statement that America is addicted to oil. And he proposed a series of technological initiatives to address this dependency. First, he announced that since 2001, we have spent $10 billion to develop cleaner, cheaper, and more reliable energy sources. And he announced a 22% increase in clean energy research at the Department of Energy. And third, he boldly stated his goal to replace more than 75% of our oil imports from the Middle East by 2025 and make our dependence on Middle Eastern oil a thing of the past. Some, however, have suggested that the devil may be in the details. They cite as examples. The $10 billion in 5 years for clean energy sources actually translates to $2 billion per year, of which the greatest majority are going to the president's two favorite sources, clean coal, and his new best friend, nuclear, leaving a few hundred million for others such as solar, wind, and geothermal. The 22% increase in clean energy research, which has averaged about $1.5 billion per year, is a bit misleading as it is a comeback position following a 5% cut, so therefore the total growth in investment turns out to be less than $200 million per year. And that 75% needs a little deeper analysis, as currently the U.S. gets about 20% of its oil from the Middle East. Therefore, the carefully crafted 75% of Middle Eastern oil translates into a 15% increase in sources other than the Middle East. Now, where do we go for that? Particularly if Venezuela continues its errant ways? Does the name Anwar perhaps come to mind? We'll keep you posted. Last week we talked with a researcher at the San Diego Zoo who said that a report about the future of orangutans had just come out and things did not look too good. Well, the report is out and she was right. Things do not look so good. Due to the loss of forests for lumber and palm oil plantations, the orangutan is reaching a point where the genetic diversity needed to keep a healthy population alive may be reaching its de minimis. At a certain point, genetic defects become in a sense concentrated in the remaining population, which cannot support a population large enough to survive. Based on these new findings, which shorten the time until extinction will occur, the orangutan is in very serious trouble. In response, various international agencies are proffering demands for a rapid restoration of the Malaysian forest in which the orangutans exist and the establishment of wildlife corridors to permit the open movement of individuals. It is becoming increasingly clear that a time of significant loss of some of the world's most amazing animals is accelerating to a head in the future which grows nearer and nearer, faster and faster. Do something today. Take a stand. Speak out. Speak up. And take action. Astrophysicists are going planetary as they try to decide if we are going to add a 10th planet to our solar system, which, as anyone who has attended grade school well knows to be Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, and now UB313. A little-known debate has raged for years as to whether Pluto should in fact be considered a true planet, as opposed to merely a large chunky rock twirling amongst the Kuiper Belt, 97 times as far from the Sun as our little chunk named planet Earth. In reality, scientists have been able to prove that UB313 is 435 miles larger than Pluto. So, what's the question, some ask? And it gets complex because then some ask, so why is Pluto a planet? science. It's based on facts. And in another dimension, last year the world's smallest fish was discovered in the collection of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego. The little anglerfish was just smaller than a quarter of an inch, which is quite an accomplishment for such a complex fish that includes a dangling lure with which to attract its prey, which quickly end up inside its gigantic little mouth. Well, scientists in France announced that they have a fully grown male fish that is, okay, 6/100ths of an inch longer, but its body is so thin that it is transparent. And then, as if that weren't bad enough, Australian scientists have a smallest fish that gets pretty darn close to San Diego's smallest fish. The debate is just how small is small. Is it smallest in length or smallest in bulk? Ponder that. I hope you're able to sleep tonight. And that's the news. And now a few reminders. Next week, we head on out to Yellowstone Park and talk about the status of the reintroduced Yellowstone wolf pack. Things don't look too good for them right now, and we'll give you an up-to-the-minute assessment of what's going on there. And then it's down to New Mexico to talk about the effects that the new push for oil and natural gas exploration is having on a sixth-generation ranching family. It, too, is a story that needs to be told. And that is what we do here each week, bringing you the voices of the earth so that we can know the state of our world, our wonder, and the challenges we must face. It's here every week on the Wild Side News. So I encourage each of you to help spread the news. Tell your friends and encourage them to tune in each week. We'll be glad you did. Thanks.
A number of years back, I lived in New Mexico on 16 beautiful acres south of Santa Fe, across the deep arroyo, where our good friends Rick and Phil and a dog named Apache. She was a beautiful silver Siberian husky, one of the most beautiful dogs I've ever seen. One of the first times I met Apache was at a party at Rick and Phil's place. I remember talking with someone late in the evening when the edges get a little fuzzy. I turned to find this elegant, smiling-faced dog following our conversation. She was absolutely upright. Her face was at our level. She kept herself upright by standing on her two hind paws and touching my arm so lightly with one paw that I could not feel it. Now, we had a wonderful dog, a Navajo dog named Bean Dog. Bean Dog and Apache became great friends. Bean Dog acted like a wise old grandma to this young female from across the arroyo. As fine a dog as Bean Dog was, Apache was a natural rebel. Rick and Phil had chickens, magic chickens that laid pastel eggs. But Apache didn't hesitate killing any hen that flew out of the pen, and this was the beginning of real trouble for her. For you see, Rick and Phil also had a bright green parrot that would fly out each morning and return each evening. Once, when Rick and Phil were gone, the house sitter discovered the great parrot dead. Apache had, for some reason, killed it. When Rick and Phil returned, this was the last straw, and although Phil was ready to kill her, he didn't, and Apache was taken to the Santa Fe Humane Society and adopted by a doctor in Taos, 80 miles north of Santa Fe. And it was about this time that Bean Dog one day walked away, as dogs do, and never returned. We knew that our neighbors were upset with Apache, so we went to talk with them about adopting Apache to find out, but unfortunately found out, that they had already gotten rid of her. In a few days, something magic happened. Apache returned. She knew where home was, and within approximately 3 days had traveled cross-country over 100 miles to be back home. She had simply shown up one day with that smile. It was the smile that worked the magic. So we felt it sort of an omen that we were meant to have her and imagined that we could get her to understand that she was to now cross the arroyo to live with us forever. I will always remember how she followed us across the deep arroyo, and from that day forward, lived with us. Apache was a dog of great passion and imagination. One day Apache disappeared. She was gone for days. Then suddenly she reappeared, excited and smiling, greeted us wildly, gulped down a bowl of water, wolfed down the food that we had put down for her, and then went bounding wildly out the back door, running full speed towards the deep arroyo. We went across the arroyo to Rick and Phil's, but they hadn't seen her for a long time. Days went by, and then one day the same scene happened all over again. Leaping into the house, greeting, drinking, feeding, and gone. Then the pattern changed. She would visit almost every day. It was as if she was excited about something. So finally one day, when she dashed off, we followed her, and she ran off, her lithe legs flying as she ran across the land and quickly into the deep arroyo. We followed, but she was gone. We called and whistled and called again, but she was nowhere to be found. In the deep arroyo, there was an old coyote den, which dug back deep into the mud bank about 10 feet. Could she possibly be there? We needed a flashlight, and when we returned and shone the light into the deep hole, two eyes and that smiling face beamed from within. This continued for weeks. We learned that she was likely waiting for puppies, but alas, as days turned to weeks, no puppies, and then one day she was back. Not as exhilarated, but she was back. She had been caught up in a false pregnancy. She was an animal of raw instinct. She grew and matured, and false pregnancies happened about once a year. We grew accustomed to her disappearances, but she was a great dog, and mellowed a bit with age. But not much. She could run like a cyclone when she wanted to. One day, we came home to find Apache peering steadily like a pointer, her attention fixed on something under the house. This was the first time I'd seen this behavior. As I followed her gaze, I noticed a rattlesnake coiled up by our outdoor propane bottles. I thought he'd scare it off by throwing a few rocks into the bottles, but this only drove the snake deeper under the house. Realizing this could be a long wait, I determined I had to remove the snake from potentially under my feet permanently, and I did. One day, Apache returned at the end of a desert summer's day and could barely make her way up the steps. She was walking in slow motion. One foot moved slowly up to the next step, then her body trembled up, and this continued on into the house. She inched her way across the wooden floor, then dropped. Her breathing was heavy and burdened, and we noticed that her neck seemed to be swollen. It took a while to notice the two small punctures on her black lower lip. She had been bitten by a rattler. We drove her off to the vet, who gave her the antibodies that might help her live, and then we waited, and the effects of the venom were ferocious. Her head and neck swelled until she did not even look like a dog, and she laid motionless for 2 days. Then, on the third day, she managed to get to her feet and slowly made her way to the door. She trembled down the steps and then slowly walked away. It was difficult leaving that day for appointments in Santa Fe, but we had to, and we figured nature would handle this. When we returned in the evening, there was no Apache. It was a long, awkward night. In the morning, we headed out, calling and looking, but finally made a slow, rambling walk back to the house. Tears in our eyes, our beloved magic Apache was gone. As we sat on the steps, a familiar sound caused us to look up and out, and like a crazed angel, Apache ran at us, leaped past us in one bounding, joyous flight, came back and licked our faces and danced and smiled. Apache was back, as always in her own spirited way, and she was completely restored. No swelling, no slowness. It was as if a miracle cure had taken place. We never came to know how this happened, or what made her so well so suddenly, but I've always imagined that that evening she met a coyote trickster who recognized her for what she was, a spirit of the wind and earth, beautiful, lithe, and he worked his magic. The creatures on this earth, they are so much more than we generally acknowledge. I personally believe each one is as present in their world and in their self as anyone I meet. And this will be how I know the world for all of my life on this earth. For me, my belief gives me more than I could ever lose, even wondering if I am right or wrong. It really does not matter. It is a divine gift that enriches my soul.
Our wanton anthropomorphizing continues as we head on up to Montana and look at dogs who save our lives. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Next time you find yourself lost on the side of some remote mountainside, just some simple misstep on a path or a misread on a map, and a few moments of confusion and disorientation, and then the realization that you are really lost. As you wander, trying to find your way to discovery back home, your family and friends realize that something is wrong. Search and Rescue heads out to find you, and when they do, they call the experts. Yep, the canine search teams. When they come back, the canine search and rescue dogs here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One of the things that fascinates me almost more than anything else, and certainly inspires much of what I do here on the Wildside News, is the amazing truth about the capabilities of our animal friends. And none touch us more directly in ways that we sense our profound personal and in ways that we sense our personal and powerful than the unique bond between humans and dogs. Today we continue to celebrate our canine friends as we talk with Sam High, who is talking to us from Helena, Montana. Sam is a trainer and tracker for the High Country Canine Search and Rescue Dogs team. Sam, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much.
Say, if you were to head out on a search and rescue mission today, what would you be looking at in terms of Helena? Helena. Yeah.
As far as, well, terrain, it's mountainous here. We have mountains in the area, or in the state, I guess, up to 10,000 feet or so. We also have flatland in the state, so we can be looking at a variety of different terrains that we might be working in for a search.
Now, of course, that high altitude really affects the type of weather that you have to face in terms of your mission as you head out with your dogs, and we're going to cover that topic in some exciting ways today. What kind of weather conditions do you have to face once in a while?
Well, a lot of it, right now, it's a little cool. It's about 35 degrees. With the altitudes in the mountains in this state, the weather can change drastically very quickly. So you could be out in a nice 50 or 60 degree day, and a storm can move in rather quickly, and your temperatures can drop 40 or 50 degrees an hour with rain, snow. So you have to be prepared for any kind of weather when you're out on a search, because you never know when you're going to get back in. You could be out for several days or even overnight, and it really pays to be prepared for all different types of weather conditions.
Well, let's talk about the High Country Canine Search and Rescue Dogs. You're involved, you're a dog owner, mm-hmm. You're also a trainer, and one of the things I think the audience would like to know about would be the fact that a lot of people think of search and rescue dogs, and they kind of think about police dogs, but quite honestly, there's a huge difference between the dogs that are trained to work with police and the dogs that you train to help out in search and rescue.
Yes, that's true. A lot of the training is similar. It's just kind of the expected results might be different on the other end. And we look for people who are lost, hunters, hikers, bikers who are out in the mountains or just looking for the outdoor experience, and they get turned around and get lost. And our dogs are trained to find them and come back and get us if we're on a wilderness-type search, and then take us back to that person, whereas a police dog would be more for containment when they find that person. They probably would not come back and get the officer. They would stay with the person they're looking for.
Now, you work strictly at the behest and by request of official search and rescue teams. Is that right?
That's right.
And so you get a call, and then, now, one of the amazing things about your particular organization, and something that we're certainly going to address today, is the fact that you work entirely as a voluntary organization.
That's true.
You don't ask for any dough, do you?
No. We try to get donations, and anything that anybody's willing to send our way is much appreciated. But we don't charge for our services to go out on the search. We do request, if possible, that we get reimbursed for maybe our expenses, but we don't charge by the hour or anything like that. It's completely volunteer.
And all the gear and things you have to come up with yourself?
Yes, we purchase all of our own equipment. If we can come up with enough donations, or we're trying to write some grants to get some funding, then we're trying to get the company to be able to buy a lot of our equipment for us. But right now, all the individual members have purchased their own equipment.
Well, actually, I made a little special effort here because I really think that, well, what you do literally saves lives. It really impacts families. It impacts your community. And it also stands as a tribute to what great community efforts people like yourselves can contribute to. And so, actually, I went around and talked to some folks out there who want to help you guys out a little bit. And so I'm going to actually introduce a friend of mine, Angela. Angela, you're with us, I think?
Yes, I am.
Now, Angela, who are you with?
I'm with Talus Navigation's Magellan GPS Consumer Products. And we have a special surprise for you, Sam, and would like to donate four Magellan GPS receivers, our Magellan Explorus 300 and Meridian Platinum. We hope that this, for those instances where people are out there and aren't using a GPS receiver, to help them get back to where they left their car or where the trailhead is, we would love to supply you with that as a tool to help you guys find people and mark where you've already searched. And we know that this will hopefully be a huge contribution, considering that you guys have to pay for everything yourselves, and we really value search and rescue operations all around the country. So we hope this helps.
It will help a great deal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Angela, tell us how people can also learn more about these. It's a very generous donation, and you're giving four units?
Yes.
That's fabulous. Thank you so much.
At www.magellangps.com, you can find out about all of our handheld GPS receivers, Magellan brand, and we also have the vehicle navigation systems. It's a huge advantage to be able to know your location, mark waypoints for where you started and how to get it. It'll even give you breadcrumbs to help you get back. Apart from it being something that people use for fun, it's definitely a helpful technology in making sure that you're safe when you go out on trails or on mountains, you know, climbing, biking, as you mentioned, hiking or hunting. So Magellan's definitely always willing to try to help some of the nonprofit organizations and volunteers like yourself.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Angela, so much. That's Angela.
Yes.
With Talus Magellan. You see their products all over. Thank you so much. This is going to definitely help them out. Thanks.
Thank you.
You bet. Here we go. I'm working this board. This is getting tough on me here. Hold on just a second. Sam, let's talk a little bit about, you know, you have to go out and you have to deal with the problems of people who are injured. In some cases, you actually track down folks who have passed away. How do you train people? How do you train dogs to search out these different sort of missions?
Well, it depends on kind of the information that we get at the beginning of a search, but all the different things that we want the dogs to do are just training with different commands, and there's always a reward. Most of the dogs who have the drive that's necessary like their toy. They have a favorite toy. And so we utilize that favorite toy as a reward mechanism for when they do the things that we want them to do correctly. And there's different types of disciplines. We've trained them in tracking, which is on lead. So if we have a known point where a person might have left from and we have some scent articles from that person, we can start them at that area and try to get a direction to travel. And we give them one command for that. If we're not sure or we want to send dogs out ahead of that tracking dog, which are called area dogs or wilderness dogs, then we give them a different command for that, and they're taught to actually go out offline, search areas, help us grid an area. And if they find someone on an air scent, then they will come back and get the handler, give them an alert, and then take them back to the person that they found.
Now, you folks sometimes head out for kind of extended periods of time, don't you?
Yes, we do.
And so you put yourselves at risk as well as the dogs. That's an incredible service. It's just amazing. You know, actually, I have another person online here who has heard about your mission and would like to talk with you. And this is Frank. Frank, are you there?
Yeah.
Hey, Frank, why don't you tell about yourself and your company and what you'd like to do?
I'm the marketing director for Adventure Medical Kits and one of the co-founders. And what we'd like to do is offer a little support to your organization, and a lot of the people you're going out there to rescue are some of our core users of Adventure Medical Kits, or perhaps should be. Maybe they should have brought one along with them. But we'd like to offer you $500 worth of Adventure Medical Kits products. Your choice, because I know you have a lot of different needs. We have medical kits. We have survival items like emergency bivy sacks, reflective blankets, survival tools, and things like that. So I'd just like to offer support.
Okay.
Appreciate what you guys do.
Frank, I'll help you follow up on that. And also, Frank, how can people find out more about Adventure Medical Kits, which are the leader in terms of backpacking gear and medical portable medical gear?
Yeah, you can find out about us at AdventureMedicalKits.com. And we've been supplying the outdoor industry and outdoor users for over 15 years with medical kits. And many of the top guides in the nation, you know, 70 Mountain Guides, XM Mountain Guides, use our products for their trips and expeditions.
Well, Frank, with Adventure Medical Kits, that's a very generous. It is going to help immensely.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Frank. Well, that was Frank with Adventure Medical Kits. You see how well this works, the community outreach and the support that we can gain, and it certainly is inspiring that those people involved in the outdoor industries are prepared to help folks like you out. Well, let's continue our discussion. Now, how did you get involved in this, Sam?
Well, we've always had pets, pretty much, and when we lost our last dog, we decided that the next one we had, we wanted to try to do something with, to get have a working dog and not just a pet. My husband is formerly involved in law enforcement and has spent a lot of time out on various deals with law enforcement, and so he retired from that, and we decided that we didn't want to just completely retire from everything. We wanted something to do, and since we were going to get another dog, we thought that that might be a good thing to do. So we purchased the dog, and we managed to find the person who trains all of us, Chris Goodhue, who's one of the founders of High Country Canine, and she doesn't live that far from us, and we managed to catch up with her and start training, and it was just one of those bonds that worked out really well. Worked really well as a team. There were already a couple of other people that were involved in some of the dog training that we met, and we just really made a great team. We all work really well together, so we have the extra benefit of not just working the dogs, but finding some really great friends, too. And we ended up washing our first dog out. He just didn't have the drive, and so we now have two more that are both certified. My husband has one as well, and that's kind of how we got started.
Now, if a person were interested in joining this search and rescue canine teams, I understand that you offer some excellent training as well. Why don't you tell us about that a little bit? How to find a dog and how to choose a dog, and we don't have a whole lot of time left, but let's try to give an introduction to that.
Okay, well, probably the best thing to do would be to check our website, and it gives all of the different disciplines that you can train the dog in. It also gives we do provide seminars that we charge for. We try to keep the charges down as small as we can so that people can afford to come. We're not really in it to make a ton of money just to pay our expenses and try to gain something, but we also want to keep the cost down so that people can afford it. But you can check that. We have seminars for trailing, wilderness, HRD, water, and our schedule's out on the internet on our website. As far as picking a dog, we test them when they're 4 weeks old and at 7 weeks old, and they're looking for high-drive dogs that have a lot of ambition and enthusiasm and assertiveness, to some point being stubborn. We kind of like the more stubborn dogs because they're a little harder and a little bit more driven. And there's certain tests that you can do, too. So if anybody's really looking for that, they can get a hold of one of us. Chris Goodhue has tested quite a few dogs, as has Janet Wiltz, and they're both founders of High Country Canine, and they are also listed on our website. So that send an email or give us a call, and we'd be happy to help them out.
Well, now, where do you want them to send an email? Let's have your web address, and if it's
okay,
a phone number.
www.highcountry.com. H-I-G-H-C-O-U-N-T-R-Y K as in the letter K, 9, dot U.S.
Terrific.
And our phone numbers are all on that website.
And just as a little aside now, there was also a gentleman, Bill Bates, and he has a wonderful invention that I think you're going to find kind of interesting. It's called the air grill blower. He couldn't be with us today, but he also wants to help you out. The air grill blower is especially designed to blow air on glowing coals. If you're in a fire and you want to get something started, you may be a little high country and a little short on air, you just crank this thing. It has a direct stream of air, and it just takes fires and embers, or gets a fire started again to stoke the embers. It's a fabulous thing, and he wants to help support you folks. You crank this little handle, and you watch the glowing embers blaze, and there's no batteries or no chemicals. It's lightweight, it's portable, and he's donating 12 of those to you folks to spread out through your crews out there. And I just want to say that you can check out the Air Grill Blower at www.airgrillblower.com. And they're even offering free shipping through the holidays. I want to thank Bill Bates for that generous contribution to you folks.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Well, listen, now what else do you need? What? How can people help you out? What are you looking for these days? And how can they support your supporting us?
Well, if somebody is really wanting to get involved with us, so we're looking for a boat about 24 foot long, sort of a pontoon boat that we can. We have two divers that are also in our group, and our dogs are trained to work on the water so that we can go out and search on lakes and things like that. We're also looking for a trailer to carry all of our equipment and our dogs and things like that when we go to a search.
You know what, Sam?
Have it one place.
Let them contact you.
Yes.
When we come back.
And now, coming up, a story that will live with you for a long, long time. It's the story of Hawk, a canine companion. It's another in today's wanton anthropomorphizing. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Just how far can our connection go with the animal world? We love our pets, they entertain us, they are our friends, but perhaps we have only scratched the surface of what is possible. Today, we look at canine companions, dogs who give their lives in service to us. It's a story you will always remember, and you'll hear it here when we return on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Welcome back. All of us who love nature here on the Wild Side News find our own special ways of connecting with it. Some take to the rivers. We head to the fields with our field guides and binoculars. We write, we paint. I've always loved animal communication. It's a wonderful science. It's actually the science of ethology. But today, I want to explore the art of animal communication, because it can reach a rather high form. The communication that exists between animal and human. And I believe we are about to take a journey that is real, rich, and wonderful. Today I have as my guest a truly amazing guy, David Ball. David, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
David, you have the opportunity to communicate with an animal that very few people will ever or could ever have. You have a friend called Hawk. Is he there with you now?
Yeah, he is. Huh? Yeah. You want to say hi? Speak to him. Oh, speak. Speak. Say hi to everybody. Come on, say hi. Speak. There you go. There you go. Good boy.
That's great. That's Hawk, by the way. And now Hawk is with you everywhere you go, I guess. Let's get started. Tell us your story of how it is that you and Hawk have become so connected. Start at the beginning.
Well, back in 1989, I had a truck accident in which I broke my back and became a lower-level paraplegic. Got a side effect of a disease that's eaten away at my nerves, and over the years I'm able to do less and less. So I went to an event through a rehab hospital, and I saw a person with a service dog. I got to talking to them, and they put me in contact with Canine Companions for Independence out of Oceanside, California. And I applied and went through the application process and the interviews and got accepted, and ended up with a wonderful dog named Hawk here that helps me with everything in everyday life.
Well, we're going to talk a lot more about that in the time that we have here. It took you quite a long time to be able to get to Hawk. Talk about that, about the way in which the Canine Companions, there's a terrific need and actually a bit of a shortfall. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yes, well, I applied back in 2001. The application process took about 6 months, and then I was put on a waiting list. And I was told at the time that it could be as many as 5 years before I would get my service dog. I got lucky. For some reason, there was a cancellation. Somebody couldn't make the class, and they called me in. And Hawk happened to be there at the same time. It's a match made in heaven.
Well, I'll tell you, I was actually out at Canine Companions this last week here in outside of San Diego, and it's an amazing place. That is where you actually went through your training and met Hawk, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. Let's talk about that training, because I tell you, people need to know about this. First of all, I'm just going to give a little background. Canine Companions raises special dogs. They actually have puppy raisers, and so all over the country they have people who raise these dogs. This certainly is something that our listeners could participate in, and I highly encourage them to consider doing this, because the need is so terrific. The puppies get special training. They have to learn 30 commands, and those that can pass that then move on to the facility. Let's talk about what happens then.
Well, at the facility, that where the dogs, and I do stress that the dogs make the choice whether this is going to be the life they want or not. They get advanced training, learning how to work with wheelchairs, other medical devices, working around them, getting comfortable with them. They learn advanced commands such as turning light switches on and off, opening doors, picking items up off the floor, pulling people around in wheelchairs, a whole variety of things. The dog has to make the choice. There's a lot of people that think, you know, the dog's going to make it when they turn them in for advanced training, but if the dog doesn't want to do this, it's not going to.
You know, you mentioned that actually what happens is once you get into the training, it's a two-week intensive. And from what I understand, it's a terrifically emotional, challenging time. Let's talk about that training, because I was there during a training session, and that is precisely it. There's a lot of pressure. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of anticipation. You know, you go down there, and you almost feel like a kid on the first day of school. You're introduced to all these new people and these wonderful dogs, and almost immediately they start working you with them, trying to find a match for you, the dog that'll bond with you the best and work with you the best. And, of course, everybody picks their favorites, but, you know, to quote another graduate's phrase, you kind of hold your breath until they make the permanent match, which is at the end of the first week. And we work 6 days a week for 2 weeks with these dogs, and we go on outings. work with them there at the facility. The second week they spend entirely with us, 24 hours a day, you know, part of the bonding process. And, you know, everybody picks their favorite dog, but the dog also has to pick the owner. And the trainers do a great job of matching them up. I mean, everybody that graduated in my class has got the perfect dog for them.
Well, you talked about the fact that you had a bit of anxiety and hope that the hawk in you, somehow it seems as if you connected from day one. It's almost like a romance. So there's a connection, a special magic. And I guess that day actually did come, and talk to us about that, when finally you and Hawk were officially partnered.
Oh, that was the highest point in my entire life. I've never felt so happy, so optimistic. I went from dealing with this disability and the things that come along with it to an optimistic view of what my future was going to be, what Hawk was, you know, going to do for me, the doors he was opening for me. It's indescribable. I mean, how well he makes you feel about yourself. All the dogs, everybody that got matched up, you know, it was, their matches made in heaven. They are like a romance.
You know, you talked about the fact that before Hawk, your life was much more isolated, and society reacted to you in actually sort of distasteful ways. Talk about what happened since Hawk has come into your life.
Yes, you know, beforehand, people, they tended, in my experience, and I'm not saying this is for everybody, but in my experience, people tended to shy away. They didn't want to talk with me. You know, I was on my own, so to speak. But ever since I've had Hawk, you know, people, they want to come up and talk. They want to find out about Hawk and what he does for me. They want to spend time. They want to see some of the stuff he can do. It's a whole new lifestyle. You know, it just pulls a person out of their shell real quick.
I found that to be the story amongst different people who have their dogs, that it's a totally life-changing experience. We have about 2 minutes left, David, and I'd love to hear some of the highlights of this, of what has happened. You only had your dog since, I think, February this year, is that correct?
Right.
Yeah. Talk to me about some of the miraculous things that have developed between you and Hawk.
Hawk's been there for me. I've had, you know, a couple bad weeks where I couldn't do anything just because of pain levels, and he would sit right there by my side. He's almost gotten to the point where he can anticipate my needs, even when I'm, you know, physically down and unable to do much. You know, if I want to go to the refrigerator to get something out for supper, he knows that that's where I'm headed, and he opens that door for me. We get out and I'm getting tired or something, he moves just a little bit closer and positions himself so I can grab his harness, you know, like he's ready for me to pull, or for him to pull me. He's bonded with me much more than I ever thought was possible.
You know, I heard, most of the, actually, the commands are very direct, and you have to kind of guide the dog through a series of very specific commands to get them to do things, but I've also heard that that you and Hawk have had some special moments. For example, if you'd care to share the fact that at night sometimes you've had difficulties, and there was apparently a moment where Hawk seemed to instinctively know what your needs were. Can you talk about that? We only have about 30 seconds left.
Yeah, it started back in team training, actually, the first night he was with me. He figured out that at night, when I flip and flop at night, the pain is what keeps me up. I couldn't sleep much. So from the second night on, he gets on the bed with me. He positions his body in such a way to hold me in one position all night, comfortably. It's not uncomfortable. We're both real comfortable, but I can't turn over at night, and I sleep the whole night through now.
David, thank you so much. I wish we had 2 hours. Maybe we can do that sometime. I want people to go to Canine Companions. That's at cci.org. David, thank you so much. Remember, next week, we're off to Yellowstone to take a look at wolves, and then on down to New Mexico for a special show on the effects of oil and gas leasing on a sixth-generation ranching family. We bring the world's best voices of the earth to you each Thursday or any time on the archives. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again. here on the Wild Side News.